Bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. It's Wednesday, May 13th. Four bills on our agenda today. And I think we're going to start out with Senate Bill 623. So I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 623. Victoria, would you give us a little preview of Senate Bill 623?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 623 directs the Public Utility Commission to allow higher water rates for metered water systems serving fewer than 500 customers. It passed out, it was voted out of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation, 5-0, passed the Senate 25-4 with one excused.
Thank you. We have one person signed up at this point on Senate Bill 623, Mel Olson. Good afternoon. Welcome to our committee, and if you would identify yourself for the record before giving your testimony.
I'm Mel Olson.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Holvey and members of the House Consumer Protection Committee, good afternoon. My name is Mel Olson. I am owner-operator of Highland Water Corporation, located in St. Helens, Oregon. I want to thank you for taking the time out of the committee's busy schedule to hear Senate Bill 623 today. I would like to thank Senator Betsy Johnson for introducing the bill at my request. The basic purpose of this bill is to give private water systems of less than 500 customers an option of charging more for metered water. The present situation is that up to $33 per month is an uncontested rate according to the rules of the PUC. So a private water system can charge $33 a month or less, and customers do not have a right to appeal to the PUC for rate regulation. The situation is, if you have just a service connection to the water, then the water is a flat rate per month because there is no measurement of the amount of water that you use. If meters are installed in the water system, and we have both kinds of systems under our jurisdiction, we still are held to the $33 per month annual average cost for having water service. Now, a water system that's operating with meters has added expense in the fact that you have the meters. First, you have the cost of the meter. You have meter reading. You calculate the usage of the water, which is office time, and the billing is done accordingly. Plus, you have replacements of meters. They do wear out. They do malfunction. And so there's a labor investment there, as well as equipment to replace the meters when it's necessary. My experience with working is that it takes about an extra 50% of cost to take care of meters. Recently, I replaced a meter on a service, and it was a little bit exceptional, I'll admit, but the company was out over $400 in parts, labor, time, materials, everything that was involved on that particular overhead item. And so that's why I brought this bill before you, is so that water companies have an opportunity to charge a larger rate if they meter the water and keep records accordingly. So that's the purpose. In the past, the PUC has not considered metering as an extra incentive. Also, it's a very well-known fact that when water is metered, water conservation immediately comes into accountability, because the customer is accountable for what he's using, and if it's not metered, there's no record. I had an experience recently where I installed a meter on a system, and they had no records prior to this. And when I told them the amount of water that was going through that water system, they were just astonished at, wow, do we use that much water? And it really brings an awareness to the customers. Another thing that's involved with metering of water is the customers are paying their fair share for the water that they receive. If a customer uses a large amount of water, he pays a larger water bill. If the customer is conservative and uses very little water, their water bill is down. With a flat rate, everybody pays the same, no matter how much you use. And so this is really a very fair way to have the customer billed by a water system is with meters. But if there's no financial incentive, or you could say on the other side, we're penalized for having meters and not reimbursed for the cost of them, that's a reason for a water system to overlook meters, to not install meters. And so that's why I'm proposing here that we have some kind of remuneration, some kind of a balance in the situation. This is not a goal that metering is done statewide on every drop of water. That's not the intent here. This is to help the PUC with another tool to regulate water systems in a constructive way. If anyone has any questions, so I could address them, you know, that you better understand.
Thank you.
I would like the committee to understand as well as I do what we're working at here. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great goal that we all share. I'm curious. I don't see the PUC here today. Have you talked to the PUC on this bill at all, or has the PUC weighed in on this particular bill that you're aware of?
Yes, the PUC has weighed in. Mike Doherty is in the audience.
Okay. I appreciate that. Questions from the committee?
Will someone from the PUC be coming up?
They're not currently signed up, but I intend on asking the PUC to weigh in on this bill.
Thank you.
Whether today or some other day. Questions? Thank you. I think it seems like a somewhat straightforward bill, and it looks like it shared a pretty good support on the other side of this building, but I would like to hear from the PUC on this as well. So appreciate your testimony today, and is a member of the PUC here willing to testify today? I appreciate you coming forward then. Good afternoon. If you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Mike Doherty. I'm staff at the Public Utility Commission. The Public Utility Commission doesn't have any concerns about this bill and supports the bill.
Pretty short. Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, is there anything in law that prevents the PUC currently from having two different rates?
Right now, there's different levels of regulation of water utilities. The first level is what we call their exempt from regulation, but if they charge $18 or more, they come under what we call become a public utility, where they're regulated for service. Then they're a service regulated utility, but if they charge up to $33, they don't come under regulation unless there are some service problems, discriminatory problems. But once they charge more than $33 as an average monthly, then customers can petition the commission to bring the company under full rate regulation. So right now we have about 35 rate-regulated public utilities. We have about 48 that are service-regulated. And then there's thousands that don't fall under the commission's jurisdiction.
Follow-up. I'm not sure I got my question answered. Currently under the law, if they charge... Who sets that $33 level?
That's done by a rulemaking, so it's in rules.
Okay, so follow up, Mr. Chair. So my question is you set that by rule. Can't the PUC set two by rule? Can't they just set two levels, one for metered water systems and one for unmetered water systems?
The statute that governs it say that is the statute says to set a threshold, and so that's what's in statute, to set that threshold and then to create rules about when customers can petition for regulation. I never had the discussion with our council about if we can have a double standard on that. We do have different thresholds for different type of companies and different type of customers. So a small commercial is a different type of threshold. A large commercial is another type. I don't know if it can be done without statute. It may be able to. I never had the discussion.
One final comment, Mr. Chair. As I read Section 7, or Subsection 7, it says the Commission shall adopt rules, plural, establishing maximum rates, plural, for water utilities serving fewer than 500 customers for the purpose of determining whether a petition may be filed under Subsection 6B of this section. I'm willing to be convinced, but I don't see the need for the bill. It seems to me the PUC is able to do this if they want to distinguish between the two.
I would have to ask our council about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? I'm curious if this bill were to pass, at what point would the PUC step back in and regulate? I mean, would they, if this bill passes, you'd be able to raise the threshold, I assume, to above the $33, and the bill doesn't set any kind of new threshold in it. So what happens with the utility? What if they decide to charge $100 instead of $33? And at what point does the PUC under this bill, if it were law?
Chair Holby, what we would do, we would initiate a rulemaking and then get a collaborative effort from companies and customers and other stakeholders and come up with some kind of mechanism to establish what that rate should be. And so I can't tell you what that rate would be, but we would use different inputs on trying to set a rate that kind of takes in consideration the average rate of investor-owned utilities, what their rate is, what the threshold for non-metered. There would be a rulemaking that we would initiate.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? I appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
And Representative Wingard, would you like an answer to your question before we move this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 623 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 377. Victoria, can you review Senate Bill 377 for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 377A allows consumer to request annual re-rating if insurer uses credit history or insurance score in rating of personal insurance policy. Requires insurer to re-rate within 30 days of consumer request. Prohibits insurer from raising consumer's premium based on re-rating information if consumer requested re-rating. Requires insurer to reduce premiums on consumer's personal insurance policies if consumer qualifies for a more favorable rate. Requires insurer to apply same standards at re-rating as used during initial application. Prohibits insurer from using re-rating credit information to increase insured's personal insurance policy premium. Requires insurer to reduce premiums on certain related policy lines if consumer qualifies for more favorable rate. Establishes effective date of rate change as date of consumer's request for re-rating. Allows insurer to provide difference between current and improved rate as credit upon renewal if re-rating request is received within 60 days of renewal or if an improved rate is less than $10. Requires refund of unearned premium if policy is canceled or not renewed. This bill was voted out of the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs 3-2 and passed in the Senate 18-11 with one excused.
Thank you. And up to testify, we have Gerald Rothenflum.
Rothenfletch.
Yes, sir. And George Starr.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Consumer Protection Committee. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Rothenflesh, and I reside in Clackamas County. I am here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 377, the Credit Scoring Improvement Act. I am a recently retired independent insurance agent. I have 46 years of insurance experience. I am also the founder and president of the Consumers and Agents Action Committee, which strongly supports this bill. Credit scoring for insurance underwriting has been a controversial issue for many years. Many agent organizations, such as the United Farmers Agent Association, the National Association of State Farm Agents, and National Association of Professional Allstate Agents, and other independent agents groups, have historically opposed credit scoring because we do not believe there is valid correlation to justify its use. It was these agents group that came to the Oregon Senate in 2003 with Senate Bill 260. In its original form as passed by the Senate, Senate Bill 260 was a total ban of credit scoring. It was then modified by the House of Representatives, where it was comprised down to a partial ban with some consumer rights. It is precisely these consumers' rights, including in paragraph 2 of ORS 746-661, that I wish to address and clarify. Consumers have the right to ask for a review of their insurance credit score once a year. The current statute allows companies to raise or lower rates based on the re-rated score. It is self-evident and historically inaccurate that most consumers insured by companies who choose to raise rates will decide not to exercise their right to ask for a review. They face the huge disincentive of having to pay more for all their auto and home insurance. Most consumers can't take this risk. It is a fact that Allstate and State Farm are two major carriers who do choose to raise rates. If a consumer's new score comes back lower, it is understandable why there have been very few Allstate agent and State Farm customers who have asked to be re-rated since 2003. In stark contrast, Farmers and Safeco agents have explained to me how those companies have made this review process very easy and rewarding. Up until April 18, 2009, a Farmers agent could tell their agent about their right to ask for an annual re-rate, and when their client gave them a verbal okay, that agent could run a new score immediately. If their score had improved, then the agent could tell them how much they would save on each auto and their home insurance. The data was quickly transmitted to their operations center, and the company mailed refund checks to that client, along with the ongoing lower rates. Safeco agents can still do it this way. Farmers agents must now get a signed request for re-rate and then send it to operations for processing. Farmers and Safeco agents believe that consumer-friendly rescoring builds stronger relationships with their clients. Client retention is good for the agent and the company. Some companies may testify against this bill. Please take into account that there is no adverse selection against any company if this bill passes. The insurance industry has strongly asserted for years that credit scoring has a valid correlation between a consumer's credit scoring and their future loss potential. Therefore, using their own logic, if any of their clients have an improved credit profile during their due their own hard work and diligence, then that client is a better risk and deserves better rates for their cars and or homes. Is there a risk to the companies if a consumer gets a worse score? There is still no adverse risk to the company because most companies are able to and choose to surcharge any client who has a chargeable loss. Please realize that the consumer is probably going to continue paying premiums to that company because their worse score means they cannot reasonably hope for a better rate with another company. Loss surcharge protocols within the companies protect them against drivers whose loss records actually, in contrast, potentially turn worse. Senate Bill 377 has two significant timing elements. First, companies must respond within 30 days and make any subsequent rate changes effective to the date of request. The reason for this is the current statute does not address the timeliness issue. And I am advised that Allstate and State Farm chooses to hold off running rescore for up to 5 months. A consumer credit score can change a lot in a period of months. The procedure needs to be timely. Second, the bill clarifies that if a company uses credit at any time in the underwriting process, that its customers will have the right to ask for a review. That is critically important because some major companies have interpreted the correct non-time specific language to mean that they don't have to respond to a request to re-rate their older policies. How do they get there? Since the current statute does not allow them to use credit on renewals, they claim that no credit factor is currently assigned with a less favorable rating. This refusal to provide re-rates is corrected by inserting the time-specific language of Senate Bill 377. I'd like to make one final point. As previously stated, current statute allows companies to raise rates if a consumer score comes out lower. I believe this does not honor an inherent principle of consumers' rights. I believe consumers' rights should be consumer-friendly. Why would the 2003 legislature create a consumer right to be re-rated if they weren't interested in actually helping individual consumers? It appears that the language allowing the potential of higher rates was an oversight in the 2003 session. I speak as a retired agent, but also for agents of companies who want to treat their clients better. Many of those agents cannot testify for fear of retribution if they speak out on the issue. Those agents do not want to see any of their clients punished just because they asked for a review. It is vitally important that this becomes part of Oregon law. Thank you for your time and consideration. Oregon agents and consumers have been forced to live with credit scoring for many years. It is my hope that this Credit Scoring Improvement Act will reward thousands of families who have worked hard to improve their economic condition. Jerry Ruff, question.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions, sir?
Well, I think we'll listen to the next testimony if you have anything to add.
Okay. Good afternoon, members of the House, Chairman Holby. I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 377. My name is George Starr. I was a farmer's agent for over 36 years, and as of 3/11/09, I became an independent. As the usage of credit scoring has become the standard, Farmers Insurance was a leader in addressing the issue of saving the client money due to updating their credit score. They made it very easy. I'm sorry to say that Farmers has taken a step backwards as of 4/18/09. Agents are no longer able to view an insured scoring symbol, which hinders the agent in servicing its clients. Farmers will say it's a privacy issue, but I find it hard to believe since the access to client information is restricted to authorized personnel. You may hear testimony, as we did in the initial Senate hearing on this bill, that some or a lot of the processes to develop a credit score may take more than 10 days because it's done by hand. It's not done by hand. This is totally false. As a farmer's agent, it took me approximately 10 seconds, not 10 days. I get on my computer, I run it, and it's there immediately. As an agent, all we have to offer is service. If a client's score improves, he or she should reap the reward for that effort. I wholeheartedly disagree with the use of credit scoring. I believe it's an undignified way to tell a client they're not a good risk, even though their driving record is clean and they have not had a claim in at least the last 5 years. Due to your poor credit score, your rate is high because you're a potential claims risk. Then if you have that claim, as predicted, your rate is surcharged as a penalty for that claim. As a lifetime Oregonian, I'm outraged that we allow this double jeopardy, and you should be too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Quiet committee.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Matthews.
At the risk of... Gentlemen, I've seen you before in another committee. I believe you testified on another bill. And,
yes.
And as former agents of that industry, now that you're current independents,
mm-hmm.
I appreciate what you bring, and I appreciate what you bring into your clients. But I just want to make sure we're not getting caught up in a way of, and I don't want to accuse you of doing this, but I need to make sure that we're not caught up in the middle of something where, you know, there's bad blood, and now we're crossing a bridge. And I'm just simply asking the question that this is truly in the best interest of clients. I get that, and that's where you're coming from. And it's nothing about going back on agents that perhaps didn't support you in the end. Because I remember that bill distinctly in your testimony.
As I stated in my testimony here, you know, Farmers still is a leader in regards, but when you order that score, and that score improves, you can immediately give it to them. Yeah, and if that score does not improve, and in fact it goes down, you get to keep the old score. So, no, there's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with that.
No, there's no animosity there. This is straight up.
I can appreciate that. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Currently, how many companies out there do auto insurance?
Oh. I would say probably, including non-standard, substandard, preferred, I would say 150 to 300. That's just a guess. Believe me, there are a lot.
So 300 companies?
Okay. Other questions? Representative Riley? Not seeing any other. I think your point is relatively clear about the use of credit scores and your opposition to the industry doing that and not passing on the benefit of the credit scores to the consumer. And it appears that it did pass the Senate. So I appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Committee, I am somewhat shocked that there is apparently no opposition to this bill. No one signed up to testify against it. Although the vote from the other side, I guess the bill was amended on the other side, so maybe the amendments took care of the opposition.
Well,
is there anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? Oh, there is.
He's looking for opposition.
He's in opposition. He jumped up and said nobody was opposed.
Oh, by the way. Welcome Chair. To the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, my name is John Atkins. I'm a legislative assistant to State Senator Suzanne Bonamici. Senator Bonamici was the kind of the primary driver behind this bill on the Senate side. You've had some testimony about the need for the bill and why we're doing it and the industry and the state of affairs. I just wanted to give some brief testimony as to the amount of work that we did with the industry to make this bill workable. It's my understanding that we have moved all of the industry advocates to neutral on this bill, and that's the reason that you don't have anybody testifying against it. There's several things that we did to get them there. We amended it several times in committee. It came up a lot. I think our committee members on that side are a little sick of it, actually, now. And to the point that at one point we actually pulled it back from the floor because we found another wording change. Somebody came to us late. We wanted to make sure that we had everybody neutral on this bill, or at least neutral on this bill. Farmers Insurance Group had asked for an increase in the original 10-day re-rating period, as had Progressive Auto Insurance. We gave that to them. We moved it to 30 days. This eliminated their objections to the bill. American Family Insurance wrote that, and this is one of the issues that a lot of people have brought up as one of the main reasons they opposed the bill, but American Family Insurance wrote, Senate Bill 377A prohibits insurers from increasing premiums based on re-rating requested by the consumer. We do not oppose this requirement. They did, however, ask for a change in language, basically requiring that a consumer request on each line rather than request for all of their policies with a company. We acceded to that request. You now request for your auto insurance policies, and they'll do all of your auto insurance policies, your request for your home policy separately. We did change the language such that it no longer says you only get one request per year. You get one request per year per line. We also, at the request of State Farm, we added a provision that was described in the summary of the bill that allows the policy or the unearned premium from the policy, if the policy rate improves, to be returned as a credit on renewal rather than having them cut a check if the request comes within 60 days of the next renewal or if it is less than $10. If you decide to cancel your policy or don't renew your policy, they still have to cut you a check. That's we did all these things, and as a result of that, I think everybody's neutral on this bill. Everybody who was opposed to it is now neutral.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did it come up ever, because the thing I get concerned about, if you get people starting to tap people's credit over and over to see where their credit rating is, you actually are putting marks against their credit and affecting their credit score negatively. And did that come up at all?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, the issue relates, the question that you're raising has to do with how many of these requests end up being made, and as only one is allowed per year or one per policy line per year, we're talking about basically at maximum two or three requests per year total. In addition, the score itself is an abstraction of the credit information that you would get from your normal credit report. It's not exactly the information in your credit report. It includes that information, but it also includes several other elements, or actually includes a specific part of that credit report. So it's not, you're not requesting the whole slew of credit information every time you make one of these requests. But again, the maximum number of times that this is likely to happen total over a year is three or four, something like that. It's pretty low.
Thank you. Question, Representative Krieger.
There was 11 people voted against it. Do you know what their concern was? I assume by the time it came out, all the amendments were in.
Chair Holvey, Representative Krieger, that is correct. There were still some concerns on the floor. There wasn't a substantial amount of testimony against the bill on the floor, so it's more difficult for me to describe to you the reasoning behind why there were votes against it on the floor. I do know that the vote in the end was bipartisan. There were people crossing the aisles actually in both directions. I know that the original vote in committee out was less bipartisan, and the reasoning there was simply that some people didn't feel that adding requirements to how insurance companies deal with their clients was fair. They in fact, I think Senator George went so far as to say, I agree with you that this is best practices. I just don't think that we should require best practices. And we disagree.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some concerns with it, just the fact where we're going to have people going in and checking credit or asking them to do it, and that actually weakens people's credit score. Then the other fact of the matter is there's over 300 companies out here, and we're telling them all to do the same thing when one of them could take that as best practices to elevate themselves above the others. I mean, this is a business decision, not something we should legislate, I don't think.
Got a question? You care to respond?
Absolutely. Chair Holvey, Representative Widener. Companies that engage in best practices are very often putting themselves at a competitive disadvantage. And if we want to maintain best practices in an industry, we'd like to either reward them or level the playing field. We think that this bill levels the playing field.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'd like to understand a little better the 11 no votes after the amendments that apparently moved everybody to neutral. So I'm looking for some more information there. Secondly, in general, our insurance code is already quite complicated, and I have a concern that these types of well-meaning measures tend to cost shift. That ultimately there is a reason why credit scores are being used, and that if you essentially freeze an insurance company's ability to perhaps charge someone more that they think might be a credit risk, they ultimately don't take a loss. They just cost shift that onto the other ratepayers. So that's where my concern would be.
Chair Holvey, Representative Wingard. Again, I don't have perfect knowledge of the reasons that people make their votes. I do know that who voted which way is available on the record, and I would certainly encourage you to talk to those who voted on both sides of the bill. As to whether or not cost shifts can happen as a result of well-meaning measures, it's possible, but without a specific mechanism for understanding how that's going to happen with this particular bill, and certainly when we consider that this bill is largely about making sure that we increase fairness in how credit scoring is used, and this policy issue has already, relatively speaking, been decided that in 2003 we decided that this is how we wanted credit scoring to be used, and this basically is a strengthening and clarification of that measure. I think that policy issue has been decided. We decided this is the side that we're on, and I think we're trying to just make the law work.
Thank you. And I see that you had, Senator Bonamici had six hearings or something to that effect on this bill. And the previous testimony just, discussion with Representative Wingard indicated that insurance companies also levy a surcharge when people make claims to recover that kind of cost. I don't know whether or not that came up in discussion on the other side, and whether or not that keeps the other ratepayers from bearing the burden of that claim, I guess, so that claim doesn't end up being spread out and raising everybody's rates. I would guess that was the discussion. Could you comment on that?
Chair Holvey, we certainly agree, and we certainly did discuss that we believe that it's better practice overall and probably more efficient to have people who have demonstrated a risk when driving an automobile to be paying the higher premiums rather than people who simply have bad credit scores.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can remember back this discussion of this originally, and I had a difficult time consistently seeing the relationship between credit and risk in a lot of young people. Some, yes, but there were a whole lot of them got hung up in the credit card. They were giving them away easy. They got kind of in debt. And there was no relationship that I could see. Even in my police days, that 28 years, that didn't match up with those young people that they were more of a risk. And I think that I'm still not convinced of that to this day.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I think I read some statistics somewhere,
too.
But I'm not really sure that single mothers, for example, are a higher risk than others. And I don't know if that's really the case or not. I can't remember where I read that. It's probably in a magazine.
Mr. Chair, there's an explanation to that. If you're a single mother raising kids, working, trying to clean the house, teach the kids homework at night, you're stressed. You're tired.
And your credit score may not be all that good either.
Right.
So
So anyway, that's an interesting commentary, I guess, from the unsophisticated up here at this point. But as Representative Riley, did you have a question?
Just a quick one in regard to Representative Widener's point about the question about hitting the score. Doesn't the current law already allow that to happen?
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, yes, the 2003 law is what created the ability for a re-rating of credit scores, and result of which this doesn't change that effectively.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Not seeing any. I appreciate you coming forward and giving us a little bit of background from the other chamber. You did an excellent job.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barton.
You know, I really appreciate the other chamber and the hard work they did on this bill. But being that this chamber did the heavy lifting on the puppy mill bill, I think they traded up.
Can't argue that point.
And were you heavy lifting yesterday? I don't remember. I haven't. Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on this bill? I'm not seeing any at this time. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 377A. Really, I'm going to stand at ease for a few minutes while I talk to us. I'd like to reconvene the House Committee on Consumer Protection. And did I close the public hearing?
Yes,
I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 377A. Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 377A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
And Victoria, is our paperwork in order?
Yes.
Okay.
No conflicts, no fiscals.
Representative Riley moves Senate Bill 377A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Wingard.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate you taking the time to discuss the bill with me before we plowed on forward. I'm going to be a no vote on this because I still have some questions about why some no votes were cast on the Senate side. I will do my homework on this in the meantime and be ready on the floor, and I reserve the right to go either way on the floor on this bill.
I appreciate that, and thank you. Representative Widener?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to follow my colleague. My concerns are I feel like we're legislating to make everybody play on the same playing field, and we're taking away from the guys that are out there doing a good job that are picking up customers because the rates are already lower because they're doing the right thing. And now the guys that are the bad actors, we're bringing them into the same playing field and creating more competition for the good guys. And I worry that we're doing something like that with this, so I need to talk with some of the people on the other side to see what went through committee as well.
Certainly, I appreciate the comments and appreciate the indulgence. But I think we're going to go ahead and move this bill forward. Cindy, could we have a roll call vote, please? Oh, did you want to say something, Representative Gilliam?
Did you have your hand up?
Well, you did first.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. Well, I apologize. I didn't see you down there.
It's all right, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I am prepared to vote aye on this bill. I was interested. I'm glad John came over. Really has nothing to do with the bill, but I was interested in his observations on the Senate side, and I don't know how long it takes. What's the tipping point for them to get sick of a bill? I just would like to compare notes at some point. We can do that after the vote.
That'd be an interesting project for your summer school. Representative Krieger.
Historically, if there's a bill of this type with a lot of controversy, normally you'll be approached by the pro and con lobby. I haven't been talked by anybody. So it was so important, they didn't do their job. I'm going to vote for the bill.
Thank you. So with that, no other discussion. Cindy, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Excused.
Representative Winger?
No.
Vice Chair Widener?
Nope.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 377A, having received the required votes, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteers for carrying?
I'll take it.
Representative Riley? Senate Bill 377A will be carried by Representative Riley. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 377A. I'd like to move on to Senate Bill 929A. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 929A. Victoria, can you read us a brief summary of the bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 929A requires manufactured dwelling park landlord to use sub-metering as billing method when landlord assesses tenant utility or service charge for water. Requires compliance by January 2nd, 2012. Limits application of measure to manufactured dwelling parks with 200 or more spaces. This bill passed out of the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs 4-1 and passed the floor of the Senate 25-4 with one excused.
Thank you. Up first, John Brenneman and John Van Landingham.
Mr. Chair, John Brenneman, committee member John Brenneman, for the record, representing Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. It's an association of park owners of about, membership of about 500. I appreciate you taking out of order. I've got a client that I want to get out of town. We don't want to keep him in Salem for too long, you know, and he's got to catch a plane, so I appreciate it. My client actually brought forward the issue of unilaterally submetering water a couple of sessions ago, two or three. John Van Landingham wrote the law. While we debated the surrounding issues in the landlord-tenant, the manufactured landlord-tenant coalition, it was important for landlords to be able to submeter water because as water rates continued to rise, if it were just included in the rent, quite often a resident would just let the water run when they were washing the car instead of turning it off and spraying it when needed. There was a lot of waste, and it was a conservation effort, and it was meant to keep the rent and cost down of living in a manufactured home park. When 929 was heard on the other side, our group opposed the mandate. Again, I testified in here on 2383 against it a week or so ago, and the same reason applies. We wanted to take it back and deal with the issue that was brought up in the coalition so we could deal with a lot of issues, and we will. We're committed to work on this in the interim and come back with a solution. I did ask the bill sponsor for an exemption that apply only to parks over 200 spaces. The park in her district that brought this bill is a large park of 450, and it was causing my members a lot of heartburn to be faced with this mandate when they didn't know the answers to how they're going to finance it. For instance, can it be Bancroft? So that the park owner doesn't have to take everything out of their pocket or find the financing for it up front. And then the question remains then is how do you recoup that cost? And in some instance, some jurisdictions are going to charge more for a permit, while others are going to be pretty lax. And so we've got a lot of issues surrounding this. We are now in a position, because we got that amendment for exemption for the smaller parks, which are mostly my members. We've taken a neutral position. Thanked the bill sponsor for working with us to help me clear a political problem within my organization. You see, I don't have any of my members here today in opposition and upset, and they're committed to working on this. John came up because we've worked on this issue, as I said, in the past. And we'll be back working on it here, and we think submetering water is a good idea. I mentioned the one thing that's really an important part of this discussion that occurred on 929 is that we thought the EPA had primacy and that it was a situation where you really had to be a water system in order to submeter. And the state has taken the position that they have primacy and we can do it. The clearing up of that issue means a lot. A lot of my parks will go ahead and move in there, but they've been told in the past that you're kind of running the risk. If you do this, you may not comply with EPA and their doctrine, and so we're happy that question got cleared up. And on their own, we'll have members to go ahead and submeter them. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center in Eugene. As John Brenneman said, this is not a coalition, a manufactured housing park landlord-tenant coalition bill, but it amends a coalition law that we negotiated in 2005. A little bit of background. Park landlords recover for water in one of three ways. As part of the rent. As a pro rata basis, sort of per space is the most common way. Landlord takes the water meter, comes to the park, gets divvied up within the park. The landlord gets billed by the water utility and divides it by the number of spaces. There are a couple of other ways, but that'd be the primary one. We refer to that in the law as pro rata. And the third way would be by submetering. And with submetering, there's actually a meter on the pipeline at the resident space, so that the resident gets built only for the amount that the resident consumes. A lot of park residents, as you know, are elderly and single. They often feel treated unfairly if they're paying the same amount in a pro rata basis or in the rent basis as someone who has five teenagers taking two showers a day. So residents like the idea of submetering. Landlords like the idea of submetering because most parks initially charge for water in the rent. Water used to be cheap. And it was easier administratively to just include it as part of an operating cost in the rent. So a lot of park landlords have historically recovered for water in the rent. As the cost of water went up, landlords wanted to get out from under that. And they couldn't because landlord-tenant law prohibits landlords, park landlords, from unilaterally amending the law. So they could only amend the law if the residents agreed to it. What we did in 2005 was allow landlords to unilaterally amend the rental agreement to switch from in the rent to submetering. So it was a compromise by residents giving up something they viewed as a right, but in exchange they hoped to get more submetering. As John Brenneman indicated, we've run into problems in the last 4 years with the EPA trying to make this work. There are other issues with submetering. The coalition's bill this session, 772, which may or may not come to you, it's in Ways and Means right now, tries to correct some of those problems. There are more. And what this bill, 929, will do is essentially say to the coalition, go figure this out and come back in 2011 with the issues resolved. We expect that Senator Bonamici, who's the sponsor of this bill and who initiated it, it's not a coalition bill, it's her bill, would be a part of that discussion. Be glad to answer questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Widener.
Just looking at this and knowing that you're neutral on it, these are already, most of these are under the PUC already, correct? The most of the landlord parks?
So, Chair Hovey, Representative Widener, these parks, if they're acquiring water from a municipal or a public utility, particularly, say, in Eugene, with the one I'm used to, Eugene Water and Electric Board provides water to the park. So they are not necessarily a utility. If it's their own water, the bill you heard earlier, where, for example, it's a well, then yes, they are a utility and they have to comply. One of the issues here has been whether the federal EPA is saying that you've got to be a utility if you do this. We think now, as John Brenneman said a few minutes ago, that that will not be required, and park landlords who provide water that they obtain from a water provider, such as EWEB, will not be treated as a utility and will not have to jump through those hoops. John Brenneman also has experience, and we've had conversations with DEQ that indicate those hoops aren't that bad anyway. So we've got a bunch of work we can do to encourage park landlords to submeter. A long answer. I'm sorry.
That's weird.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, it's nice to see you back and getting along. And a bill you don't necessarily disagree on. I'll start with you, John Brenneman. Can you explain to me why the manufactured park owners are neutral on the bill and not in favor of it? Since I thought what I'm hearing from both of you is that everybody wants to do this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, I have some members that are extremely upset that they're still being given the mandate and oppose the bill. The majority of my members are small parks that are 200 spaces and smaller, but I do have some that are larger. You're going to hear from another member of the coalition, I think, in a minute, in opposition to the bill because some of his members have larger parks. We don't like the mandate. If I were to say we supported this bill, creating the mandate, I would be in trouble with my organization. But I don't feel that we can continue to oppose the bill when I got what I asked for, which is get most of my members out of the mandate, which was strictly political. My people want to move ahead with submetering water. They think it's a good idea. They just don't like having their feet stuck to the fire again.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So this question is to both of you. I still don't understand why we need the mandate. If what I'm hearing from you is that most of the park owners want to do this, and you got your issue with the EPA cleared up, and it seems to me that it's in the park owner's interest to meter, why do we need the mandate?
Answer this one and keep John Brenneman off the hook. John Van Nanningham, Chair Hovey, Representative Wingard. There is at least one large landlord who is in the metro area, who is, from the resident perspective, the source of many of the complaints about water, both in terms of applying the law and in terms of not maintaining the water system so that water is leaking and residents' bills are unfairly high. That landlord, although it participates in the coalition,
is not willingly going to negotiate this issue. My own view, and I'm not a, I'm also neutral in the sense that the coalition hasn't taken a position. My own view is that it would help us to force that landlord to negotiate this issue with this bill. And that is, that landlord is active in Senator Bonamici's district.
Mr. Chairman, John Brenneman here again, just to add another comment about it. This isn't the first time that my organization's been drug in to deal with an issue that's been brought up with the attorney that represents this particular park. It's been other parks that he's represented, but there's been, I think, an issue where it just pushes the envelope a little too often, creates a political problem for a legislator, and here I am again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today, and hopefully you can get your client out of this building as quickly as he wants to get out, or she. Next up, I would like to have Corey Poole. And Chris Christensen.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Corey Poole. I reside here in Salem, and my I'm the third generation owner of Paradise Island Park here in town.
I'm Chris Christensen, the current manager of 6 weeks of the Terrace Lake Mobile Home Park, or Senior Park, rather, on Robbins Avenue, just off I-5.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
If you'd like to begin, go ahead.
I'll go ahead.
And if you might move that microphone a little bit further away from you.
Oh, sorry.
You're that sound better? When you're, yeah,
all right. All right. Sorry. I can't hear it in my own ears. You know. Our park has been family-owned and operated since the summer of 1965. I'm third generation, as I said. We have 214 spaces. We have a very good relationship with our tenants. In fact, in 44 years of operation, we've never had an eviction. I'm here to tell you that Senate Bill 929 will hurt family-owned parks like ours. Parks like ours, including other Salem parks, Sundial, Terrace Lakes, have often included water and sewer with rent. Our park includes everything except for electricity. This makes it easier for our residents and for us to deal with the billings. We have always been concerned about water conservation. Every few years we offer a toilet tune-up for our residents, no cost to them. We go around and we'll replace flappers and valves and toilets. This has resulted in significant water savings over the years, I'm sure. This, in addition to other water-saving measures, has gotten our average winter per household usage to 4.9 units compared to Salem's general average of 6.5 units per household. So we're not wasting a lot of water. I don't think we'll see a significant amount of water savings through submetering. Installing submeters will be very expensive and quite disruptive to our residents. In many cases, we cannot isolate a home from the water system except under the home where the meter cannot be read. This would require to install a meter at the street or near the street. We would have to shut off large areas of the park at a time while each new home is hooked up to the meter. In addition, this would cause damage to the landscaping, which we and our residents take great pride in our park. I understand some park operators do not always appear to operate in the best interests of their residents, and I'm just asking you not to punish us for the actions of other park owners. As a potential solution, perhaps the submetering requirement could be a condition based on excessive per-unit water usage when there seems to be obvious waste occurring. Or you could require it when a majority of residents request it. I think there are many ways this bill could be adjusted to target the you know, probably individual park owner that they're trying to target with it. Very few parks probably warrant this measure. We have no interest in starting a utility service charge. We enjoy being a full-service park. Our residents are elderly, and it makes it easier for them. And I'm asking you today to help us continue to operate as we have for 44 years by not requiring us to submeter. Any questions?
Thank you. Seeing any, go ahead and give us your testimony, sir.
Yes, Chris Christensen. I, too, am the manager of a senior park. The owner is out of the area and couldn't be here today. I am the manager. I'm not the owner, so I'm speaking for myself personally. I have been a landlord in the past. At the facility so far, I've had complaints about mossy roofs and rocks in the driveway and one water complaint that a valve wouldn't shut off completely when they tried to fix a leak inside. I have not heard any history of water problems at our own. But speaking for the owner, I see that for 200 units here, I've heard the figure $400 passed around today. I think that's probably light to have a meter actually put in. 200 units at $500 is a cool round $1 million bill. Okay, that ultimately is going to be reflected if the law says, well, you can't do it right away. That means we're taking a hit. Kind of like paying $100,000 for a 50-mile-a-gallon car. I mean, I can't quite see the logic here. I've heard that there is a kind of a target area, namely another park in the state, which I know nothing about, but that I know there can be abusers. Abusers are the ones that generally make action happen to some of the people that are also in the loop, but catch the heat from the abusers. And as a park of, 200, a little over 200 units, I'm wondering if the number that's being proposed here isn't smaller than the size that it takes to affect at least the current main offender. The idea of average water use in a senior community is almost a moot issue. We have garages, carports. When people wash a car, they wash their car. We don't have teenagers that take hour-long showers. I would estimate that our own park usage, purely out of the air, is running real close to Mr. Poole's average also, but again, that's just a guess. I personally think that this, in its current language, is quite restrictive, that if the number were changed to exclude us, that would be a step in a direction I'd like to see. Question?
Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, you may have said it, I might have missed it, but tell me how many units each of you have?
214.
The park lists space number 221. Looking it over, I see the absence of some numbers, so 220 is really close.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to call Peter Ferris and Don Miner. You both know the drill.
Good afternoon. Vice Chair Riley and the rest of the committee. My name is Peter Ferris. I live at the Bayview Manufactured Home Community in Walport, and I am the citizen lobbyist for the Oregon Manufactured Homeowners United. I can give you a little bit different perspective because I have been working in the last year with the people at Heritage Village, which is owned by Cal-Am Properties. And in fact, there are not just one large park, but there are four others. There are five total Cal-Am parks in which they have manipulated this system. And what they have done is coerced people into signing new rental agreements. So this is a big problem. It involves probably over 1,600 people. There are some other problems that I often hear about water elsewhere, but this, I would say, is the most egregious landlord in the state. And it's they're very big landlord. They're out of Costa Mesa. They have probably 350 parks nationwide, and they have deep pockets. And what happens with, let me just give you a couple figures about what's happening at Heritage Village. Currently, the water and sewer rates are $154 a month. The stick-built homes in that same neighborhood are $45. We do have also evidence that last year the Heritage Village park was losing 1,300,000 gallons per month, wasting that water. And what the problem is that they have a decaying infrastructure system. They don't want to fix it. They refuse to fix it. In fact, we had a promise that they would meet with the resident association there in front of me and Senator Bonamici, who's done such great work here. But they are now stalling, and we don't expect them to do anything. So our real problem then becomes, how do we have any kind of consumer protection here? We have met with the Attorney General. And we don't know what he's willing to do, but I think we have a big problem here. And so for someone to say this creates a political problem, this is a huge problem for the residents. Because many of them, some of them are losing jobs, their rent there is close to $700 a month. In addition to that, there are 75 vacancies in the park. These are some abandoned homes. They are also homes that people had just left and deeded over to the owner because they could no longer make the payments. So this is the problem. And in terms of costs, I mean, in terms of submetering, I think submetering makes really good sense. I mean, and I agree, and I'm glad to see that coalition folks feel the same way. But, you know, I would suggest to you that there might be some cases in which, because of where the current water spigots are, well, it might be more expensive. But I have heard estimates of $150 per unit, $50 for a meter, and $100 for installation. Now, I think if a manager or an owner shops around, they can find a deal like that. And it seems to me that submetering is such a fair issue, because if you're living alone and you have somebody next to you living with six people in the house, then if you don't submeter, you are paying the same amount. And in terms of pro rata, I don't think it works very well. You know, it just doesn't work very well. So I think we have a real problem here with regulation. And I know that, you know, the park owners don't like their feet, stuck to the fire, or, you know, I know that that's the case. But what are they going to do about these rogue owners? This is the problem. And, you know, Cal-Am parks are, the one is 200, is four, well, it's actually 350 now, because there's only 350 people, I mean, 350 units there. But the other parks are, one is also under over 200, but the others are under 100. So why should we allow these people who are using this system to really what is a kind of theft, to my way of thinking, and a kind of double billing, why should we let them off the hook? And I don't see how you can do this. I don't see how you can say, I would prefer 100. But that brings in a lot of other people, but, you know, I think there's other good policy reasons for submetering in general. It's certainly, besides being fair, it's economic. It will, water is going to become much more expensive down the line. We know that. We know it's going to be more expensive. And also, it's just environmentally, people are going to say, hey, I can't pay this bill as water rates increase. Tualatin Valley Water District has increased their rates 13% in the last 2 years. Having said that, I think the big problem with the submetering for Cal-Am properties and maybe a few others is the fact that when you submeter, it shines a light on the infrastructure, and they don't want to shine a light there. And in terms of having IDing the people who have an excessive water use, those people, well, you can't, if you are a water district, you can't go into the into that private property and test. You can't do that. So, it would be nice to know which ones are losing lots of water, wasting water, but you can't go there. So, this is a real conundrum. And having said that, I will take any questions or...
Thank you. I'm going to ask Mr. Sure. Miner to go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner, here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association, and more specifically on behalf of Joe Van Haverbeck, who owns a Country Village Estates. Now, our association doesn't oppose submetering. The earlier speakers said, in fact, this whole dialogue that has gone on in the legislature has been helpful in identifying that... the fact that parks can submeter. Previous to the last few months, actually the last several weeks, we thought that it was almost prohibited to be to submeter unless you became a utility. But we've discovered through the Senate process that that's not so. So I expect that you will see more parks on a voluntary basis submeter. Senate Bill 929 applies only to parks larger than 200 spaces. Mr. Van Haverbeck's park is 500 spaces, so moving the line a couple of notches isn't going to help. I think he's the largest park in the state, and as far as I know, there are no consumer complaints that have been lodged, at least in my memory, against this park. So he's a very, very good operator. The other problem with this bill is it goes into effect on January 2nd of 2012. And I think that was, as was stated earlier, so you can hold a gun to the head of the coalition. And not necessarily opposed to holding a gun to the head of the coalition. But the real problems with this is it provides no flexibility. It'll disrupt tenant lives. It will increase tenant costs, and we think it's unfair. Tenants will not have a say in whether their park is submetered. If you happen to be in a larger park, you can be happy as a clam. You're going to be submetered, and you're going to suffer the costs and dislocation associated with that. The letter from Joe Van Haverbeck that I think has been circulated outlines some of that. He has his 500 and some spaces, 170 are submetered. Those are spaces he built. The spaces he acquired earlier are not. He estimates the cost, the direct cost, to be about $129,000. And it isn't so much the money. It's just the process of submetering. There's a shutoff on the house, close to the house, but the meter's going to be towards the street. So in order to... cut the line to put it in a submeter, you've got to turn off the street, all the houses there. And when you do that, it's helpful if the homeowners are home to turn off their water heaters so that they aren't damaged. They also need to be there when it's turned back on. That it's my understanding, even when it's turned on slowly, there's a surge in pressure, and that can cause pipes to break inside the home or appliances to fail. So it's helpful if they're home. And when you're doing these one house at a time, but you're shutting off the street, you can see some of the problems that are associated with that. There's also a risk of when you're cutting the lines, introducing grit and other things into the water system, and that can damage the consumer's home. Now, Mr. Van Haverbeck's park complied with all the building codes in effect at the time it was built, both the earlier phases and the later phases. Yet this measure will mandate that he reconstruct a major portion of his infrastructure. And to say the least, I think this is unusual. Normally when we change rules, we grandfather, if I can use that phrase, or grandparent, existing folks in. There's also the issue of where will the money come from? As I said, he thinks it would be a minimum of about $129,000. Right now, the capital markets are difficult, to say the least, and so borrowing will be hard. SB 772 that was mentioned earlier in the hearing was down in Ways and Means, but it's likely to pass. It's the coalition's bill. At page 9, lines 36 through 39, prohibits the landlord from raising his rent 1 year before he submeters. An existing law, ORS 90.537, subsection 4, prohibits a landlord from raising the rent 6 months after he raises the rent. So there's a year and a half gap there where you can't recoup it in the rents. And as I said earlier, I think it would be difficult to borrow. I had mentioned that we think it's unfair. Manufactured home parks aren't the only types of living arrangements that include water and sewer in the rent. Apartment houses do this, yet multifamily houses of 200 or more aren't included in this measure. And we think that's discriminatory and don't see a real rational basis for conferring this privilege on one group of landlords but not on another. As was mentioned earlier, this legislation may have been was focused on a park management company. Some of the problems that are addressed there, that were brought about by that company, are addressed in Senate Bill 772. And it prohibits the landlord from switching from charging for water in the rent to pro rata, and doing that arbitrarily. We think that that is probably a better method of dealing with it. It also allows landlords to submeter. Now, Senate Bill, as going to this gun to the head business, Senate Bill 929 goes into effect January 2nd of 2012. So a landlord, assuming that this will all be worked out and this mandate won't go into effect, a landlord would be asked to wait until July 1st, June 30 something of 11. And if the measure goes away, then there's no problem. But if the measure goes forward, if the coalition can't come to an agreement and this bill goes into effect, and it will become law when it's passed, if it's passed by this body, a landlord would have less than a season to implement it. He'll have from July of 11 to January of 12, and that won't be enough time. And so a large park owner like Mr. Van Haverbeck, if he's prudent, is probably going to have to begin acting upon implementation of this measure and can't rely on something being worked out. So he's going to have to either borrow the money or raise the rent a year in advance of beginning to act to finance this. He really won't have a logical alternative to do that. What we would ask is if the committee just insists on this measure going forward, that at a minimum the January 12 date be changed to December 12 or June 12 to give a little more time, assuming the coalition process doesn't work, for a landlord to go ahead and begin implementing this. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks and thank you for your
time. Thank you. Representative Widener. Sorry.
Don, real quick, because I'm not a big proponent of mandates. I don't like mandates at all myself. But what if we were to put this to where the individual parks could vote on it? So that way the parks where you have the problems, where you come together, the landlord gets a vote, everybody gets a vote, whether or not you put these in. And then when you're making that vote, you also are taking the liability of, I might be paying $10 more a month or $20 more a month to pay for my meter that's going in there over the next 3 years.
Chair Riley, Representative Widener, my guess is most landlords wouldn't want the tenants to be able to vote on what they do or how they charge or how they operate their community. But that certainly seems to be a better alternative than to simply across the board mandate it. It would also, it appears to me, to hold harmless those communities where everyone's happy as a clam.
I'd like to just respond to your question, too. I have a great idea, which is to actually require that all landlords be licensed. And if they fail to obey the law, then we could get the Attorney General to either tell him to obey the law or condemn, take his license away. I mean, that way you would have, it would be like a stiletto.
But I'd like to keep the conversation about this bill.
Right.
Now, Representative Winger.
Yes, suddenly, Mr. Chair, I've decided I want to participate. I am troubled by a bill that's aimed at one person or one entity. That always causes me pause. But I understand the concern about somebody who I get what's going on here, where the cost is not being borne by the bad actor, because they can pass that on to the tenants. And Peter said something that interested me, which was that, and it sounds like it's probably right, that we have a wall in the law that does not allow water companies to go beyond the property line when it comes to looking at whether or not people are wasting water. And probably I agree with that, except for when somebody has sub-clients that they're passing that water on to. And I think it seems to me that a better way to get at this, rather than dragging the whole manufactured park dwelling folks in on an issue that's really about a wasteful water and the fact that a park owner may not have an incentive to act on that waste, is to allow the water companies to penetrate that property boundary when somebody is passing the water on to subtenants, whether it's an apartment complex owner or a commercial building operator or, in this case, a manufactured park owner, to allow water companies to come in and do an assessment about whether or not the infrastructure is actually wasting water beyond a certain threshold. And then put the pressure then on, allow them to put some teeth in that allows them to, require the owner to act on that, so that the people who are at the receiving end of those bills and are sort of powerless at this point to stop the waste, which they're paying for, have some remedy.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond, Representative Wingert, I don't know how that works, whether the water supplier can come into the property or not. I just don't know how that all works. But it would seem to me that a landlord, let's say that he's wasting 20% of his water, it leaks into the ground, or some larger number in a large park, I don't know if the water bill, let's say it's $100,000 a year. If by fixing the leaks, it seems to me a landlord would have tremendous incentives to fix the leaks on his own without a third party coming in, because he could fix the leaks and put that 20% in his pocket without raising the rent. But again, I don't know that they.
I'd like to respond to that too.
Go ahead.
Well, I would say we did find a way in which we could actually without going over into private property to do this, because we just so happened to have a resident of one of our parks who is also just happens to be the administrator of a water district. So what he said was, you can put a master meter just before you go into the park, and then you set it at 2:00 in the morning, and then you find out if there are leaks. So that was one way of doing it, and we found additional leaks. The other thing I would say to you is that when you have a infrastructure, Cal-Am has brought people, the American Detection Service in, a leak detection service in, time and time again. And what happens is after they fix it here, it blows somewhere else. The whole system needs to be revamped. They don't want to do that.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don, I don't think I'm convinced by the argument that you made that the owner has a built-in incentive to address this cost. If he or she is passing that cost along, I agree with you at some point. If the rent has gotten so exorbitant that it's literally, it's hard to attract people into the mobile home park, then perhaps. But there's a wide margin in there, I think, when an owner would tolerate that waste because they are simply passing it along to the tenants, and perhaps for, you know, as you described, there's a hassle involved in getting a loan and bringing in all the construction crews and dealing with all of that. Mm-hmm. I just don't see where the incentive is until some critical, maybe systemic failure, or your rents are now three times the going rate around town and you're having trouble attracting people. Although based on our affordable housing issues in the Portland metropolitan area, I think that threshold may be way out there before you'd actually start to lose tenants. So again, I go back to this point that I think if the issue here is about large complexes that may be wasting water, I think there may be a better way to get at this than to come in with this mandate. And I have heard, I'm sympathetic to some of these concerns about some of these smaller places that have both basically senior tenants, and we're going to place a mandate that's going to cost them money because the owner is going to pass this cost of metering along to them. And if it's unnecessary, I'd rather not go down that route to solve a problem that I recognize is there. Anyway, I'll shut up.
So I want to move along. If nobody has any other questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to testify on Senate Bill 929A? Yes, please. And very quickly, if you will.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Atkins from Senator Bonamici's office. Once again, I am not the expert on this bill that I am on 377, so if you ask me tough questions, you might get an I-don't-know answer. But there are some points that Senator Bonamici wanted me to make about this bill, and I'm going to do that. First of all, I'd like to say that kind of address some of the points that have been made. I can't speak to the various alternative ideas that have been considered. I'm not a legislator, I'm staff, so certainly I think Senator Bonamici would be interested in talking to anyone who wants to talk about this bill. As to the costs of submetering, there have been several studies done on this subject. A large submetering program in the Santa Clara Valley Water District, totaling four parks with over 1,100 home sites combined, found an average cost for installation of submeters of about $172, including the submeter itself, the installation, and all relevant fees and taxes. They experienced a 22.5% conservation of water. The very next year, as you can probably imagine, the submetering program paid for itself relatively quickly. I'd also like to say that any of the costs that you've heard of, any of the problems for submetering that you've heard of, I think are also likely to happen in any voluntary submetering system if indeed the costs are so high and the problems are so grave. It's hard to understand why anyone would do it voluntarily, but I think we have heard testimony that people are wanting to do this, and I think they would only do this if it were possible for them to do it relatively cheaply and with substantial reduction in problems. That's basically what I have to say.
Thank you. Yes, Krieger.
Just the point is that you're gonna realize the savings if you got leakage. If you don't have leakage, you got the investment in the meter and the time and everything, and it could be $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 that someone's going to end up paying who's a tenant. And if it's old people, like we've heard, so identifying those that you think got leakage, how do you do that to just make them do it? I don't know how we get there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, certainly the parks that have leakages or that have leakage are going to be benefited substantially more, although I will say that as the program in the Santa Clara Valley Water District observed, it also reduces the amount of usage that individual people in the park are gonna use. They recognize now that their cost goes up when they use more, and as a result, they reduce their usage substantially. They don't leave the hose on. They don't leave their sprinkler out without a timer. They use less water.
Seeing no more questions, thank you very much. I'm going to move along. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 929A, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 771A, and I'm going to ask Deborah Imsek and John Van Landingham to come forward, please.
No.
Okay.
Not today.
Okay.
John Riley, I think they all want to come together.
No.
Thank you, Vice Chair Riley. John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center. This is the other coalition bill. There are two landlord-tenant coalitions, one that does manufactured housing parks. You've seemed to have dabbled in that a lot this session. This is the apartment one. And both kinds of tenancies are covered in the same chapter in the Oregon Revised Statutes. I've given you a handout describing that coalition. It's existed a lot longer than the Mobile Home Park Coalition one has. It's existed since the early 80s. It's produced a bill every session except 1991. But like the other coalition, it has a lot of people who participate. I would say 10 active landlords and 6 active tenant representatives. It met 18 times to prepare this bill to negotiate it. There are amendments. The Dash 4 amendments include the Dash 3. They represent some continued negotiation with landlords, especially Deborah Emsey's group in Portland, to make an adjustment that benefits them. Also an amendment at the request of the Oregon Association of Realtors. And Paul Rainey is here from OAR if you have questions about that. I don't expect you to move the bill today because it's complicated and it's late and you don't have a lot of folks.
Do we get extra points?
For staying?
For being here?
You get donuts next time.
If I were strictly following the rules, I'd have to close the committee and open a subcommittee, but we're going to finish up real quickly.
Okay.
So
I
could go through the substance of the bill, but maybe given the hour, I won't do that. I will note that the bill passed unanimously out of the Senate Consumer Protection Committee 5-0. It passed unanimously in the full Senate 28-0. I think we've addressed the concerns that have been raised. There was one person who testified against the bill in the Senate, a Salem realtor. I don't know whether he's contacted you all. We addressed his primary concern. It was the one that the realtor had, and that has to do with a 60-day no-cause termination notice and making an exception to that for sales to persons who want to reside in the home. So realtors were concerned that would discourage sales. That person also, I think, complained to Deborah, so I think we've addressed that particular issue. I'd be glad to talk about the substance if you want me to talk about the substance.
Deborah?
For the record, good afternoon. I'm Deborah Emsey, the Executive Director of Metro Multifamily Housing. We represent 150,000 units in the state, and I'm also here to speak on behalf of the Oregon Rental Housing Association, which represents another 5,000 landlords. I think that John's made it clear that we've had numerous meetings and in order to collaborate, and we think this process is a good one for vetting prior to legislation, and that's what we've done, and that's what we're here today to tell you to do. Also, in the risk of time, I'm going to kind of cut to the chase. You know, as with any compromise, this legislation isn't perfect, and there are areas of the bill that kind of, frankly, had some potential heartburn for the landlords, but we were able to come to agreement and to operate in good faith, and I think that says something about the coalition. And John mentioned the two amendments that are part of this that will change language. We are in support of both of those amendments, and both our group and RHA would encourage you to support the bill along with the amendments.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else wanting to speak on 771A? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 771A, and I'm going to close the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you.